that Buddhism has been in existence for over 2,500 years, and its first and most important tenet is do not believe anything whatsoever because I tell it to you. You have got to make it true for you. If you do not make it true for you, then all you are doing is listening to me and copying me. And I cannot give you my experience. I can tell you my experience. I can tell you what I believe. But only you can find it out for yourself. It is because of this that Buddhism does not proselytize. It does not send out missionaries. It does not try to induce people to become Buddhists. Because, you see, if I try to force you or to induce you to become a Buddhist, then I am not giving you the right to listen to what the Buddha said and decide for yourself if it is good for you. If it is good for you, only you can tell me. I cannot get inside your head, and I do not intend to try. That is not my job. My job is to present to you the facts of what the Buddha taught and what I know to be true for me. And then, if you like to believe it, good. If you like to act upon it, good. If you find some of it useful, good. If you find none of it useful, that is entirely up to you. I am out of it. All I do is present the facts. Fair enough? That is not a statement from me. Do not believe anything because I tell you. You must prove it true for yourself. That is the words, word for word, of the Buddha himself. That is what he taught to his own disciples. You must not believe anything because I say it. It is the reason that there have been very few, almost no, Buddhist wars. It is equally the reason why there has been no Buddhist hunting of heretics, and Buddhism has had some heresies at time to time. Interestingly enough, almost identical with those of Christianity. But I'm not going to go into that. But that is one of the more interesting sides of the fact. Now, the second thing. Suicide is the one and only unforgivable sin, in quotes. There is no sin, as it is understood in Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism. There are things that you better not do because they do harm to you and to other people. Now, the reason why you cannot use sin is also the reason why you cannot use the term God, although the cosmic Buddha and God are identically the same thing. You cannot use the term God because it implies a judgmental being to many people's minds. And the only person who judges you is you. Therefore, we cannot use the term sin. However, the one unforgivable sin, in the sense of thing it's best you don't do, is to commit suicide. Because supposing you do it, you now being dead have no opportunity whatsoever to change yourself or to find someone who will help you to change or to find a teaching that will help you to change. You have had it for this life. Next time round, because of course we do believe in rebirth, it is going to come up just the same as it did before, and it's going to be rougher. Therefore, committing suicide is about the daftest thing you can get up to. Now, this brings up something that has been brought up to me, especially when I was in the Far East, teaching people who were in the American forces. And that is, if suicide is the one unforgivable sin in Buddhism, how come so many of the Vietnamese Buddhist priesthood immolated themselves? And I was very concerned about this when I was in the East, I asked the Japanese about it, and the only answer I got is, perhaps they are not real Buddhists. Now, when a Japanese says perhaps something is not so, it means it darn well is not. And if he says perhaps it is so, it means it darn well is so. So the conclusion they had come to was that the people had been driven to such a pass that they had completely forgotten their Buddhist tenets and were just going ahead and doing this. And this was the opinion I got from the entire Buddhist church throughout the East. So it should not be regarded as right and normal for a Buddhist, when he can't get his own way, to set light to himself. This is a very unfortunate situation. It is un-Buddhist. It is absolutely contrary to what the Buddha taught. And if you ever bump into any Buddhist teacher who advocates it, smile at him politely and get going fast, because he's no Buddhist. And he has no right whatsoever to be making such statements. Fair enough. That's the next most important point on this. You'll see why in a few minutes. The third, the purpose of religion is to explain to us the meaning of life and death. It's not only to explain to us the meaning, it's to explain to us the reason for. Now, according to Dogen, in our most useful scripture, both for the laity and for monks, the very first thing that a Zen Buddhist learns, if he's of the Soto school, is the most important question for all Buddhists is how to understand birth and death completely. Should you be able to find the Buddha within birth and death, both birth and death cease to exist. All you have to do is realize that birth and death, as such, that is, as positions in time, should not be avoided, and they will cease to exist. For if you can understand that birth and death are nirvana itself, there is not only no necessity to avoid them, but also nothing to search for, that is called nirvana. Now, the purpose of religion is to explain to us the use or meaning of life and death. The purpose of life is to prepare us, and in some ways to help us to prepare ourselves, to become one with the cosmic Buddha. Now, it has been said that Buddhism is an atheistic religion. That is absolutely not true. What Buddhism will not say is what the cosmic Buddha is. Because if it tells you what the cosmic Buddha is, immediately something can come into your head. Well, I wonder if it has, or why doesn't it have, such and such. The Buddha himself said, there is an unborn, uncreated, unchanging, undying. If there were not an unborn, uncreated, unchanging, undying, then there would be no way of escaping despair. Now, what he is actually saying is, there is something. You can call it a great spirit, you can call it God, you can call it the cosmic Buddha, you can call it XYZ if you happen to be an atheist. You can use any term you like for it. But that is the most that the Buddha would ever say of it, other than you've got to know it for yourself. When you know it for yourself, then there can be no death, for you know where your true home is. And there can be no life other than life in this unborn, uncreated, undying, unchanging. Therefore, Buddhism is a very, very true religion, which is non-theistic in the sense of having a father figure type God, but very theistic in the sense of there very definitely being something much greater than every one of us in here. It does not dictate to us. It does not insist. I can tell you all the things it does not do. It will never hate. It will never judge. It leaves us to hate each other until we're fed up with it. It leaves us to judge ourselves and our fellow men until we are fed up with doing it. And it does not insist that we stop. It just sits there and waits and waits and waits. In Christianity, you have the words, many are called, but few chosen. In Buddhism, you have, all are called and few answer, which is quite a different thing. But if you think about it, it comes over very clearly. Therefore, none of what I'm going to be teaching you today is in any way going to conflict with any beliefs you may have. Because there is nothing wrong with saying that the Christian or Judaic God is the unborn, uncreated, undying, unchanging. I think that is about the most non-heretical statement that you can say of the Christian Judaic God, that of which I know. Everyone knows that he is unborn, uncreated, undying, unchanging. All that Buddhism will not say is the rest of the story. It will not say he created the world in 6 days. We don't know. It will not say that various things attributed to the Judaic Christian God actually happened. We don't know. What we do know is that every one of us is scared stiff of death and frequently more scared stiff of life. And therefore, the job we have is not speculating on what could have been or what was, but on doing something about what we've got right here and now. Therefore, the job of a person in religion is not to discuss whether the great flood happened or happened how it said, or whether the walls of Jericho came tumbling down the way they said. I don't doubt they fell. I have no idea of knowing and no way of checking it. It is not for us to discuss that, but to sit back, take a look at ourselves, and say, right, I'm terrified of this and that. I need to know why. I want to be able to live completely free from fear and worry and want. How can I do it? These are the things for which you meditate. These are the reasons you meditate and for which you undertake the study of Buddhism. It is not to escape from any God with whom you may have a squabble or a scrap from childhood. Buddhism is not something to which you come because the parson down the road got on your wick when you were 7 or 8 years old at Sunday school, because you are going to find exactly the same thing if you look at it truly. There is no escape from the hand of God, that is fact. And no Zen master is a true Zen master who thinks that he is the end of the line. This again is something that makes a true Zen master very different from a cult leader. He is not somebody who you follow because he knows it all. He is the only person in the world who knows he does not know it all. A true Zen master knows he doesn't know it all. He knows that he happens to be 2 or 3 steps further along the road, maybe, than whoever happens to be going with him. And therefore he can take one safe step. But that is the difference. He knows that that in which he has his roots is the unborn, the undying, the unchanging. This much he knows. His job is to show to you the unborn, the undying, and the unchanging. And the seeing and the knowing for certain of the unborn, undying, and unchanging is to have enlightenment. In other words, enlightenment is to know God. It is not to wander around waving a piece of incense in the air, making funny noises and looking stupid. It is to find and to know God within yourself, but not a vengeful, vindictive father figure, but an undying, unchanging, unceasing, an exquisite thing that is pure love, that will not judge, that will not be vindictive, but which is, in fact, an exquisite and certain knowledge, and which every one of us, black, white, green, pink, male, female, or intelligent amoeba, possesses, including this thing sitting on the floor with a bull funnel around its head. It is important to know that it is equally in all things. Having found that out, having realized that I am not sitting here as some great charismatic being that has got something that none of you've got, but just sitting here as one person who has been doing this maybe for a little longer, or maybe for a little less longer, some of you older than me, someone who has been doing this for a little longer than the rest of you, and having acquired some knowledge which I would like to share with you and give to you perhaps some of the, or show you how to obtain for yourselves some of the beautiful peace that can come from that knowledge. Because, you see, you can be completely and absolutely free from the fear of death. You can get to the state when you know that, yes, maybe this physical body will deteriorate and eventually cease to exist, but there is no such thing as death. You are definitely going to continue. Not necessarily as you are now, but who would want some of the things that we all carry about with us? But you, the real, true you, is definitely going to continue. And therefore, dying, as the world understands it at the moment, is completely an inappropriate way to take off one set of blood and bones and maybe take on another. It is just the same, if you like, as changing one's clothes. You just change your body and get at it again. The purpose for which you change your body and get at it again, so that you may continue to become better and better acquainted with the cosmic Buddha. We are here to perfect ourselves, to do as much as we can to make ourselves worth knowing. At the time of death, we will not blame ourselves for what we have done and thus cut ourselves off from the cosmic Buddha. One of the grave problems is blaming oneself for what one has or has not done. I do not know enough about the actual history of Catholic ritual, although I know a fair bit of ecclesiastical history. But I do know that the Catholic idea of having a priest, in quotes, forgive you for your sins at the time of death, is a terribly valuable thing. The priest, of course, cannot actually forgive you in one sense. But he can be there to tell you, which is what the Buddhist priest does, don't worry. None of this matters. Do not judge yourself, is what the Buddhist priest will say. God is pure love. The cosmic Buddha is pure love. If you judge yourself before the cosmic Buddha, then by that judging will you be judged. It is interesting that the old Bible has the wording a lot better than the new one. Judge not, lest ye be judged, for by that judging shall ye be judged. In other words, don't judge yourself at the time of death. And Buddhism goes along with that 100%. And therefore, to have a person present to whom you can tell what you've done and hear him say, don't worry about it. I don't blame you for this. I'll forgive you for mankind. Then you can die without any fear whatsoever. It's a very valuable thing to have a priest at the time of death. Or, if no priest is available, to know that you can do it if you're a friend to a friend. Anyone can do this. But you do have to take away the fear of judgment. You do have to stop the person judging himself. Because if he judges himself, then he is not going to die in peace, and he's going to place himself next time round at a slightly greater disadvantage than he had before. The problem with suicide isn't that it is incredibly judgmental. I judge the world as not worth being with, and I judge myself as not fit to live in it. I don't know if any of you have read Life After Life of Dr. Moody. He makes some very interesting points on those who tried to commit suicide and have been resuscitated, and their comments of, we made a big mistake. Yes, they did, because they placed the judgment, as I understand it, and this is purely me now, as I understand it, there is this pure spirit of which, in which we all partake, which we call the unborn and the undying. The dying person is coming up, the skandhas, the physical body that is falling off. And if you have this barrier of opinions in the way, then you cannot go straight and beautifully into this lovely pure spirit. And if you read Dr. Moody's book, that is what comes over loud and clear. Therefore, the purpose of life is to do something about that which is going to mess us up at the moment of what we call clinical death. If, as a result of living, to clean ourselves up, we can die with most of this stuff gone, then there is no death at all. And this is actually what the Zen master works to find out. As a result of his meditation, he learns how to clean up what his life has been, both this time and in previous times. And in so doing, this film of judgment, of opinions, of theories that he has got of himself fades into nothingness, and he goes and realizes that he is one with this beautiful, pure spirit. Therefore, when he dies, all that happens is... Are you all right, my friend? I'm sorry. It made you jump. All that happens is that the body sloughs off, but it's all the same spirit. You see, there's nothing between your spirit, which is part of the pure spirit, and the spirit itself. So the body falls away and the thing just continues. And next time round, it appears again. And sometimes it appears here and sometimes it appears there. So the purpose of life is to make sure that none of these judgments take place at death. None of these theories that we have of ourselves, none of the things that we may or may not have done, in order to reach this very desirable state in which there is neither birth nor death, but just this exquisite continuation in what can best be described as liquid love, I don't know how else to put it, in order to reach this exquisite state, what we have to do
is not wait until the last minute. It is very unwise to wait until the last minute, because supposing you, this is slightly facetious, but supposing you've got your best friend sitting there, you can't find a priest, or you don't believe in a priest, and the one thing you've done has been walked off with his wife at some time or other, and you ask him to forgive you. There is the possibility he might not, and then you're landed with this. So it's best to sort all this out before you get there. Fair enough. We do this in meditation. Now, you don't have to sit on the floor twisted up like a pretzel to meditate. It's nice if you can do it for one very good reason. If you're going to do it for any very long time, very great length of time, it will stop you from, if you get sleepy, falling off a chair and perhaps cracking your skull. The only really valuable reason for sitting on the floor, and the reason the East does it, is so that if your posture goes wrong, you cannot hurt yourself by falling. You have what is virtually a three-point seat from which it is very difficult to fall. But if you can't use that three-point seat, if you are too old, or if you just have got a set of bones that won't twist up like that, or if it is not congenial or unsuited to the area in which you live, or your family think you're a bit weird, don't think that this is absolutely essential to doing it. Because, you see, pure meditation, real meditation, is pure prayer. We have got the idea that prayer is totally different from meditation. This again comes out of thinking that the God, or the cosmic Buddha, is a big father to whom we ask for things. So we sit down, please God, give me lunch. I can remember this was a sort of attitude of mind of what prayer was when I was a small child. Or, thank you God for my good dinner. Well, that's nice, but is that all? I can remember when I was 5 or 6 thinking this was a little bit weird. There should be much more to it than that. And of course there is. I was talking not too long ago, 5 or 6 years ago now, with a friend of mine who is a Buddhist monk, not a Buddhist monk, a Christian monk, who said he wanted to have conversations with God. Now, we had been having a one-sided conversation for about 3 hours. He had talked non-stop about how much he wanted to converse with God. And eventually his throat got a little hoarse, and I pointed out to him that if he shut up and listened, God might be able to answer him. And the one thing that you have to realize in meditation or in prayer is that you've got to give God a chance. If you are so busy making noise, both literally and in your own head, you are never going to hear his voice. You're only ever going to hear yourself. So, the first big thing for anybody who really wants to truly learn to meditate or pray is to shut up and listen. Literally, shut up and listen. Now, if you've been used to making noise all your life, and university types, of which I and he, and most of the people here are one, you know that you've spent most of your life making noise either in your own head or to other people. And this makes life somewhat more difficult from that point of view. But if you truly, really wish to find the unborn, the undying, you have really got to shut up. How do you do it? Don't try to shut up. That's the first thing. When you sit down to meditate, do not try to think, and do not try not to. Just sit there. Now, all sorts of things are going to go floating back and forth through your head. They're going to do you no harm whatsoever unless you chase them. Supposing you are sitting there and there's somebody groaning up the freeway, as periodically happens. Oh, what a darn nuisance that thing makes so much noise on the freeway. You've already ruined your meditation. But if instead you're saying, ah, oh, something's going up the freeway, you're going to hear it anyway because your ears aren't stuffed up. And you're going to see cracks or flaws, cracks in the wall or flaws in the carpet because your eyes aren't closed. None of these things are going to do you any harm whatsoever. Only if you chase after them. Now, after a little, if you get used to not grabbing your thoughts and not running after them and not being hijacked by them, which is a common problem, those of us who've been in universities for years tend to get hijacked by our own trains of thought. I have a monk here who's been with me something like 10 years, who to this day can get hijacked finer than anybody I've ever met. But he's still trying. Now, if you can prevent yourself from being hijacked by your own trains of thought, after a bit, it is as if you are sitting, shall we say, by a river, and there's this bridge going over it, and you're sitting under the bridge, and all this traffic is going back and forth on the bridge, which are your thoughts, but you're sitting underneath them. And the you that is sitting underneath them is completely undisturbed. And this is your first knowledge of the unchanging and the undying. It doesn't look like much. You're just able to be, how many times have you wanted to be at peace with yourself? That's the first sign of it, to be able to just be there with all this racket going on above, and you are sitting there below it, quite undamaged, quite peaceful, quite safe, quite happy. And then, after a little longer, you begin to hear something that you heard when you were a small child. It's almost like a still small voice. Women hear it rather more than men, primarily because it has been used as a derogatory term for them, oh, woman's intuition. This little voice that says, I don't think I should do such and such. How many of you know that little voice? It happens frequently. Men need to encourage it because that is the beginning of hearing the voice of God. Now, when it first starts up as intuition, it is highly debatable whether you should completely follow it because of past experience. But if you go with it, almost always it'll be right. Every now and then it won't be. This is to discourage you from taking it for granted. You have always got to apply your own mind. You cannot resign your free will to it. And the instant you resign your free will to it and do not apply your thought, your own thinking processes as well, leaving in the back of it that this could be more right than your thinking processes, if you can't, unless you do that, then it is going to go wrong because you have resigned your will. No Zen master will ever take over the will of another person for this reason. He mustn't. All he will do is point the way. This is the way I walked, which is what I'm doing now. This is how I got there. If it is good for you to use, please use it. If it is not, that is fine. So when the intuition tells you, don't do that, it's not wise. And how many of you have gone along a road and there's been a dark alley and you've wanted to go down it because there was a fancy shop down there that you wanted to see something in, and somebody said, don't do that, there could be a mugger. Now, it could be fear or it could genuinely be a mugger. If you don't take notice of the intuition, you could get mugged. If you do take notice of it every single time, then you're going to become a prey to your own fears. You cannot resign, but you should take cognizance of it. And in taking cognizance of it in that way, gradually something develops as to which is the real ones and which is not. And this is the growing of faith, the growing of true faith in the unborn, the unchanging, and the undying. And the more you meditate, the more this faith will grow, and the more you will begin to be able to discriminate between that which is the real thing, that which is not, and how much your mind should get involved in it. In other words, you stop thinking with your emotions, stop living through your emotions, stop living through your head, and start to live through something that is much more fundamental in your guts. I can remember talking to a psychologist recently who said that he'd done a tremendous amount of stuff by the book, but in the end, most of them got gut feelings about things. I'm glad to know that we all work exactly the same way, because that's exactly how you do this. If you go with those gut feelings you should know are the instincts of your true self. And your true self is the unborn and the unchanging. So, having learned how to meditate, you can then start ordering your life by that center, or gut, to use bad terminology for it. And that will gradually teach you what to do and what not to do in daily life. It will also teach you how to clean up what you've already done. And then, when you get very, very deeply into meditation, if you've cleaned up everything that there is in this particular life, something quite remarkable happens. You go back in time through this birth to the births before it and start cleaning up what was before. And it's very easy to understand rebirth and past life if you think of it like this. Yesterday was past life. It is as far away as 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. You cannot bring back yesterday. It is no closer than 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. But we do not think of yesterday in the same term as we do then. But we weren't around then. Oh, yes, you were. If there is an unborn, an unchanging, and an undying, you were around then. You didn't look like you look now, but you were there, because you have never ceased to be. Therefore, what you did then may affect you just as much now as what you did yesterday. Why is it remarkable that you can go back in time to tomorrow and you get worried about going back in time 2,000 or 3,000 years? The answer is only because you do not know you do not truly yet know, as I know, the unborn, the unchanging, and the unceasing. When you know that, all this other stuff is like the stuff on the bridge. When you're sitting there nice and deep underneath it, all this stuff is just like the stuff on the bridge, and it's gone on for centuries upon centuries. And certain things that we have done have tended to go on for centuries upon centuries. And we've gone on doing them and taking no notice of what we've done. Just dying here, being born there, making the same mistakes, going on and on and on. And when you get into meditation, what you are really saying is, I don't intend to make those same mistakes. I want an end to it. And this is the true meaning of the word koan. I want to find the source of the koan. I want to find out why I am as I am. Let's find out the cause. And that is one of the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, suffering's cause. What is the cause of suffering for me? What was my original face? How can I find the unchanging? Let me find the unborn, my original face. And in so doing, I will find suffering's cause, which is the beginning of my koan. And everybody's koan, I have yet to find anybody's koan that did not start the same way. Slightly saddened love. An exquisite thing that went very slightly wrong. And the next lifetime it was even more wrong. The next lifetime it was even more wrong. Until you're so much off, you're almost crazy. Now, I shall be going into this in considerable detail over the next set of lectures. I really do not want to give you indigestion, because it's very easy with this stuff, and we're virtually going to do a tour de force of the whole of Buddhist teaching in 4 days, which is a bit like asking somebody to recite the Torah standing on one leg. I don't intend to do that. So what I'm going to do is stop here, have some questions, and then... Right. Anything? Anybody else got something?
You talked about the need to enter the death happening without fear or doubt.
Yes, if you, without doubt.
Without doubt, okay. And if you go into the death experience with doubt, you said that you come face to face with this something that doesn't work so well.
Yeah, well, you come face to face with doubt. And if what you see at the moment of death is doubt and not the cosmic Buddha, then what you are going to be reborn with is doubt.
So you weren't saying psychological consciousness goes past death in the form of doubt or anything else?
Yes, it does. It comes up as what is called karma. Unfortunately, the term karma has got into the English language and has got a totally wrong connotation in many respects. I have just finished, in conjunction with my friend here, a book called The Book of Life, which after I read it through, I realized was really what karma was. It was a book of how to explain karma, or my end of it was. His is slightly different, yet it's really the same thing. It's too simplistic to say that karma is, if you kick a dog, the dog will bite you, cause and effect. And yet it is cause and effect, but it's so much more than that. If at the moment of death you enter death with fear, then what you will see is fear. You will not see the cosmic Buddha, which is pure love. If the fear has been removed as a result of discovering that this thing exists from the beginning of time within you, then what you will see at the moment of death is love, and the rebirth will be an exquisite thing. In other words, you're going to get stuck with whatever you stick yourself with.
I follow you.
It's that simple.
Is that by way of saying also then that if in this life here now I experience fears and doubts sometimes that I cannot causally trace but feel that way, it's possible that at the moment of a death pass,
yes,
I yes, went forward yes, with this state of being?
Yes. And it also explains a lot of other things, and there are ways, and these are teachable ways. I'm not talking about esoteric stuff that looks high and looks beautiful and highfalutin and all this sort of thing. This is a teachable science that I'm talking about. There are ways in which you can work with yourself to find these things out, and allergies are frequently traceable to this. Either something that happened in this life or in previous ones. Tendencies, physical and spiritual, and mental tendencies are traceable to this. And that is what, in the end, you do.